with Megan and Brandon. We're here with Dr. Robert Weinberg, a professor emeriti from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. So Dr. Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us. To start off, could you give us your 30-second elevator pitch bio about where you are now?
Well, I'll just real quickly, I spent 14 years, got my degrees at UCLA in psychology and kinesiology, spent 14 years at the University of North Texas, 28 years at Miami of Ohio, and now I'm currently a recently retired and emeriti professor, as Megan just said. So I think I'm within 30 seconds.
Perfect. Thank you.
So as Megan said, so the podcast is called Ask and Answered. And so part of what we're trying to do is to get a better understanding of how prominent and key figures like yourself in our field got to where you are today. And I know you just kind of gave us a brief rundown of kind of where you've been up to this point. Could you give us a little more detail about your background in terms of like the real pathway that you took to get to where you are right now?
You don't have enough time for me to tell that story. I was asked to do a autobiographic sketch of me in sports psychology. It was a book edited on becoming a sports psychologist. And if you know, this is I picked the line from the Grateful Dead, of all people, saying, "What a long, strange trip it's been." So that's sort of my thing. You never would have expected that I would wind up where I was if you looked at my history. Okay, so you want my history. All right. So I was I was an accounting major. And I didn't like accounting, although I thought I was good at it, but I didn't like it. I became a physical education major. I was just going to be a teacher in the New York City high school, be a coach. But one of my professors, which I always tell my students, one person can make a big difference. Because of him, he encouraged me to apply to graduate school. My parents didn't go to undergrad school, no less grad school. Anyway, I went out to UCLA, and I was going to get my master's, go back to New York, and teach and coach. But again, another professor, Dr. Valerie Hunt at UCLA, encouraged me to go on for my PhD, which I did in psychology, specializing in sports psych. So I had a couple of masters, one in psych, one in Kinesis, a doctorate in psych, and then a postdoc. It was a book which most people never heard of this book. It's called The Madness in Sport. The book was, and I'm blanking on the author, it'll probably come to me. The book was basically done by a psychiatrist who was an avid athlete and was in an accident and confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And he wrote, once as a psychiatrist, he wrote about these athletes, the tennis player, the golfer, the gymnast, whatever, and the psychological problems that they had. Now, this was more clinical probably at the time, but it was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. I like psychology. I like physical education, sports science, kinesiology, and I can kind of bring those two together. But there really wasn't a field. Again, this is in the mid-late 1970s. So unlike where you guys have ASP and, you can there's a field, you have you have both in academics as well as applied stuff. You have choices of what you want to do. There was a few academic just starting at the time. There was no applied stuff, so I had no chance to do that. So the only thing was to get into a university position, and I came in second place three different times. As a job search, that's as good as 10th place, whatever. And I finally got a call from North Texas to start over there. And that's where I really got into sports psychology. I taught sports psychology. I started to do some application working with athletes. And as you know, the field started to grow in the 1980s. People started to use sports psychology, although there still was, when I went to a party, usually what I would ask when people heard I was a sports psychologist, they said, oh, you work with head cases. You work with psychos. I said, well, not exactly. I worked with people who want to get better and they're just needing to improve their mental skills and stuff. So it was from a time where I was not even thinking of such a field, and there wasn't such a field. For me to get in that was totally unrelated to my early interest in my early education.
Can you think of any particular moments over the years that really stand out to you as being kind of like pivotal in terms of you getting to where you are?
Well, again, as I said, I think that the book was very critical to me, The Madness in Sport. By Arnold Beiser. I know I remember it. I think it's 1967 book, which no one really knows about. Anyway, I think a big thing was when I got out to UCLA, I still was going to just, get a master's degree, go back to New York, teach and coach in New York City high schools. But it was my professor, Dr. Valerie Hunt, and some original work, some of my earliest publications was using electromyography to study muscles and their reactions to anxiety. I think that was like the first time that I really saw, that I can actually do research, because I was not a researcher by nature. But, doing my thesis and stuff, I was like, yeah, I can do find out about anxiety, and I can find out and measure it with some physiological measures. So I think that was a big part for me, because, again, up until then, I still was just going to go back to New York and be a teacher and a coach.
So interesting. We're looking to get a snapshot of the field prior to you being president. And I know, as you just mentioned, the field was very young, even when you became president. So maybe this is a bit of a loaded question. And similar to how you just responded, but how would you describe the field of sport and exercise psychology and ASP prior to you running for president?
Well, you know that I can't remember what I had for breakfast.
Right.
Remember 40 years ago or whatever it is. Well, I remember, I think it was NASPA, North American Society for the Psychology of Sport and Physical Activity. That was a major organization. That was the organization I grew up on. That was basically the only sport psych organization around back in the late 70s, et cetera. But myself, John Silva, and a couple others, I remember, I think it was ASP in 83 or something like that, maybe 84, we started talking about, people started to use sports psychology in an applied way. You'd find the person here or there who worked with an athlete. In fact, there were a couple of, I can't remember who it was, but a couple of sports psychologists at the World Series was focused on, like the pitcher was using this sports psychologist, et cetera. So all of a sudden, because I'm sure you both know, what we had to start out with, when you start out with a field, we had to get a body of knowledge. So how do you get a body of knowledge? You do research to get the knowledge. So that's what the focus was in our field in the 70s and into the mid 80s and so. But then we started to get some interest again in the application of sports psychology, working with athletes and coaches, et cetera. So John, myself, and a couple others talked about this, and we said, we really want to, include this, because NASPA was and is a research society, period, the end. Well, we went in front of the board, the executive board of NASPA in, again, I forget the 83, 84 maybe, and we asked them to include applied issues, particularly when we'll talk about it, I'm sure, certification. We wanted some standards for people who were working in the field. So we presented that to the NASPA executive board, hoping that they would include us and they would have some applied things going on in addition to their research, which was always very good, by the way. But they said, we are a research society and we're not interested in applied issues. So there it was, right there. That was a kind of a central moment. The one major sports psychology, or I guess the ISSP was still out, but the major one in North America, certainly NASPA, and they said they're not interested. which is fine. That's their, you know, they wanted to be a research society. So several of us, and again, John Silver being probably the lead person, but several of us went about and said, well, I guess if they don't want to do it, we got to do it, which is a big job, right? You just don't, you know, snap your fingers and, oh, I think we'll start a new organization. So anyway, we did. And so we put our head together. We had an executive board. We had meetings and stuff and said we were going to have our first conference in, I think it was 1986 in Nag's Head, North Carolina. And I think we thought maybe 50 people will show up, you know, because we're just trying to get this off the ground and who the heck knows how many people are interested in applied sports psychology. Well, there were 200 people.
Wow.
Which was wow, right. And it was like, really, 200 people? You know, I guess we have some interest here. And so really that was kind of the start. John, you know, became the first president, followed by Ron Smith and then myself. So, you know, that was some of the behind the scenes. I'm not sure if that totally answers your question, Megan, but it does show how ASP sort of evolved as an organization. It didn't just come out of thin air. We wanted to be part of NASPA. They didn't want to be part of Apply, which is their right. And we went ahead and tried to start. And there was more interest, obviously, than we realized to have 200 people show up. You know, I don't even know if we had email back then, you know, to try to get the word out to everybody, et cetera, et cetera. So
it's really interesting to think about that, of how the interest, like how you reached all those 200 people. I picture you like handing out flyers.
Yeah, probably we handed out flyers, but, you know, at NASPA, we probably called people. And again, I'm trying to think when email really sort of caught on. I don't know if it caught on quite that time. I don't think we had everyone's email and stuff like that. So yeah, it was the old time way, you know, by handing out stuff, by knocking on doors, by calling up your colleagues, by putting posters around at your different universities, whatever. So probably not the easiest, best way, but we got 200 people.
Wow. I feel like I just keep saying, wow, but that it feels so incredible. What specifically motivated you to then run for president, so being the third one?
Okay, well, I think it's really not just about sports psychology. When I was a younger faculty member like yourself, you know, just getting started, so on and so forth. So when I was just getting started, you know, there were conferences to go to. There were a few, anyway, at the time, you know, a few journals with editors. You know, there were people in service positions. And I just had to show up at a conference or read a journal. I didn't have anything to do with that. So I always felt that if I had the opportunity, that I should give back also. Because these people, the Rhino Martins and Dan Landers and so on, early, you know, in the field, Glenn Roberts, so on, you know, they were doing stuff. If it wasn't for them, I'd have no journals. I'd have no organizations to go to, you know, et cetera. So it was like, well, if people, you know, think that I could do the job there, I ought to do it. And of course, I believed in sports psychology and you know, as a field, but I think it was more me feeling that, you know, other people stood before me and, you know, I'm going to stand before others if they want that. So I think that was more the major reason why I said yes. Someone else. I got to turn this thing off.
I thought you were supposed to be less busy when you retired.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so did I. yeah, so anyway. Yeah, so that was really my reason. Of course, I felt strongly about the field, and I thought there was, you know, we were trying to get off the ground. It was obviously the early years and so on, but really it was more the form of what I just really talked about. That was the difference.
I'm kind of curious, because one of the things I think we see now is it's hard to get people to volunteer to take on these types of roles. And for good reason, in terms of other commitments, service is obviously, it's important and also not always as highly valued at some institutions compared to teaching and research. I'm wondering for you at that point in your career, when you're thinking about, you know, taking on, you know, this new role potentially, if it was an easy decision for you, or if it was one of those where you had to really sit down and kind of balance everything that you had on your plate as a young professional, you know, during a really pivotal time in the field and organization.
It was an easy decision. It wasn't a hard decision. As you sort of suggested, I think, you know, if we go ahead 30 years or whatever, you know, the external service and stuff to your organizations are just not seen as a big deal. You know, to be a journal editor back then was a big deal. You know, now it's like, well, so what? So I think you guys have more difficult decisions to make because of the way the universities are and what they value. And again, I think, as you said, they value research. It depends on which one it is, but they value research and teaching certainly over service. It was not a hard decision. It was like, well, they wanted me to run. This is a new field. I'm invested in the field. It wasn't like, well, if I do this, then what kind of I'll take away from my research. I never had that discussion, really. It was really easy for me.
So you take on this new role as president, and I guess at that point in time, what were you hoping to accomplish, you know, during your presidency?
Well, you know, it's very difficult for anyone to accomplish anything, you know, with a 1 year thing. I mean, it was really a 3 year thing. You were, right. You know, prior to the, you know, president-elect, president, past president, so on and so forth. I lost my train of thought. Let me have that question again.
Oh, just because you're absolutely right. It was difficult. It's difficult to do anything in 1 year, but as you take on that role and step into the president's role, wondering if you had any, specific goals or things in mind that you were hoping to accomplish, some of which may have happened and then maybe some that never came to fruition.
Yeah, well, I think the whole idea of certification, well, really, I think the major issue that was the driving force for ASP was certification. Okay, that whole applied sports psychology stuff. But, you know, now that there were people in the field, there should be some kind of standards. You know, what should you, ethical things, you know, what should you be doing, not doing, so on and so forth. So that was a huge thing. The whole idea of certification and ethical things. I think another thing was I felt that there was always a psychology, which still is psychology, sports science, sort of like, you know, it was like fingertips on the blackboard. It was, you know, psych people, wanted psych more. I mean, and they were maybe more versed on some psychological issues. We came out of the sport thing and we knew more about sport, but not about psychology. And I wanted us to work together more back then. And I still think that's an issue today, particularly, and you might want to get, you know, the whole idea of mental health and, you know, what kind of sport psychology person are you, or are you a mental health, so on and so forth. So that was a big thing. I also was trying to encourage the research into the effectiveness of these psychological interventions. You know, so we do imagery, we do goal setting, we do thought stopping, we do anxiety management. Do they really work? I mean, do we really have evidence, you know, to say that this helps you in your performance, or maybe it's your intrinsic motivation or whatever? So that was another thing that I was interested in trying to encourage more of that kind of, you know, because we weren't doing that kind of research, because as you both well know, intervention research is probably the hardest kind of research to do. And so we didn't have a lot of it, you know, and so we had these independent studies looking at this or that or whatever, but to get the, the science to the field, but not, you know, really the effectiveness, because, you know, that was our basic thing. You know, we have these psychological interventions. We're going to help athletes perform better. Do they really perform better? So on. So that was another thing for me. And I also wanted to, highlight interorganizational cooperation, particularly not only NASPA, but ISSP, also the Canadian group. I forget all their the letters, the Canadian Society for the Psychomotor Learning and Sports Psychology or something like that. So anyway, what I wanted to have our organizations work more together. They have done that some maybe not as much as we could, but there have been some joint kinds of things, you know, because the Canadian groups have done some really excellent stuff. And then, you know, and then try to look at it more in a kind of global sense, which of course now is becoming more and more important with, you know, it used to be you wanted to, you know, get in touch with someone in Europe, you wrote a letter. I know that sounds kind of funny. Yeah, you wrote a letter. That was even before fax. You wrote a letter and you put it in the mail and you wait 10 days, maybe if you're lucky, for it to get to Australia. And then they had to look at it and going to mail you a letter back. Another 10, you know, so it could be close to a month. Not, oh, I got an email. Oh, I got to respond. You know, someone didn't respond to your email in 5 minutes. They must be sick. You know, well, what's wrong with them? Got to check them out. So anyway, it was a slow process.
We're going to switch gears now to what is my favorite part of all of this. And we'd like you to tell us a story. So anything that you want about, something that's in the field, something that makes you happy, and preferably a story that maybe involves another ASP member.
Okay, well, you guys probably don't know this because you're so young. But, all right, so I'm going to go back to when I was president-elect. And back then, president-elect, who's going to become president, had to give a presidential address. Okay, they still do that now, but it's like 15, 20 minutes or so on. This was an hour, and this was published in ASP. Your presidential address, all the presidential addresses were published in JASP, not actually ASP, in JASP, okay? So this was a big deal. Okay, so I prepared a long time for this. I wrote out, I had 30 pages. Now, as Megan would know anyway, I never look at notes and stuff like that. But this was 30 pages. And you sort of read your, and I don't read my presentations, but in that case, you sort of read your presentation. Okay. Well, just at that time, about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before I was supposed to go, this was in Nashua, upstate, I came down with double vision. Did you know that, Megan? I don't know if you knew.
I don't think so.
Yeah, usually I don't. This is not something I usually talk about in my classes. So, okay, so I came down with double vision. Now, when you have double vision, usually you have horizontal double vision. Like, I see you guys side by side, so I would see two Megans or two Brandons, okay? But I had vertical double vision for some reason.
I'm terrible.
Okay, so I had all of a sudden, I remember how this happened. I don't remember. I remember when it happened. I was playing tennis in a tournament. And it was like in the third set, we split sets, so it was a tight match. And anyway, I went to pick up a couple of balls, to serve, and there was only one ball. I thought there were two of them. My double vision started. In other words, one ball was two. I grabbed one. It was like, no, there's nothing here. There's the ball. There's not a ball. Oh, you know. So anyway, all of a sudden it started. So I went to and it persisted. I thought, well, something weird. I'll be done tomorrow. Wasn't. So after several days of this, and you can imagine it's very disconcerting to have double vision. You can't drive because you get dizzy. It's kind of weird. So we went to a neurologist, and he looked over, did all these tests, you know, and said, well, I don't find anything. I can't find anything wrong. It'll probably go away in 2-3 weeks. But I still had double vision. So now I go to ASP. Well, I'm supposed to give the presidential address, and I'm basically reading 30 pages. I can't read because I have double vision. Everything's all messed up, right? Okay, so I don't know what I'm going to do. How am I going to give my presidential address? I have double vision. So, in fact, Ron Smith, who was the president before me, when he was introducing me, after he tells all about your, you know, accomplishments and all this and that, he goes, and I'd like to, you know, to introduce Bob Weinberg, who's not only a man of vision, he's a man of double vision. So most people went, ha, 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 it was really funny, but it wasn't funny, okay? And you wanted to have you want to have Dan Gould on this? I'm going to bring in Dan Gould. So Dan knew what I was going through, and even within like an hour of my presidential address, I didn't know what I was going to do because I could not read it because the words were jumbled because they were double vision. So Dan goes, "Hey, listen, I got a great idea." I said, "I'm gonna go under the podium, and I'm gonna." Say your, you know, like a sentence at a time, and you can repeat after me. And that's how you get through your presidential address. So I said, Dan, friends like you, I don't need. Anyway, just as a sidebar, what I did is I came up with the idea of I'm going to Xerox this in triple space. So there was more space between the letters, and they didn't get, but they still were sort of jumbled a little bit. But when I would look up and try to make contact with the audience and then put my head back down, it would still jumble up on me a little bit. And I remember that was an hour. When I finished the hour, my shirt was so soaked, I couldn't get it off. I mean, it was like I played 3 hours of tennis. I never was so focused, I'd say, at that moment to be able to get through that hour speech. So there's my story.
And I stand. That's a great one. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it was a little scary. And in 2 weeks, it went away. Just like the doctor said. No reason it came. And actually, it happened one other time while I was at Miami, actually. It also, in 2 or 3 weeks, went away. No reason. And there was probably some very, very small little thing up there that they couldn't see with the CAT scan or MRI or whatever heck they used. But anyway, I'm good.
I'm glad.
And it was that relationship with Dan that led to the two of you writing the book that you wrote that's used in every sports psych class at the undergraduate level and grad level now.
Yeah, and there's a story behind that, too.
Behind the book? Yeah. I think I have heard this one, but it's a good one.
You might have heard this, some of it. Most people ask us, well, you know, you've been writing this book. It's been out for 25 years or so. He says, you guys must have had an argument. What did you guys argue about? You know, you're trying to write this book. You know, you have to have some disagreements. Said, nah, we only had one argument. What was that? Who was going to be first author? I said he should be first author, and he said I should be first author. And let me tell you why. So you may have seen this book. Either of you have a gray book, 1984 by Silva and Weinberg?
So funny you mentioned that. That book is the reason we started this project.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we were sitting at a bar, as all good projects begin, with Doug Hankus.
Oh, Doug.
And
okay.
We were talking about like the history of ASP and basically who we would want to have a beer with to talk about the field. And Doug Hankus brought up the book, and I didn't own it. So I looked it up on Amazon. I bought it for about $8, something like that. And then we looked through all the pictures, which are great.
Yeah, pictures are great in that book.
Yes. And that's really how the project started. So that book is the reason that we decided to do this.
Yeah, well, that book has 32 contributors. And if you think doing an edited book is easy, try having 32 contributors, you know, writing at different levels, not coming through with stuff. But the pictures are the best because all these young people, you know, so they got long hair, they got their dark hairs and they got beards and this and that. I mean, you look at these people because a lot of these people were in their 30s, you know, maybe even early 40s, you know, and now they're in their 60s and 70s. But anyway, at that time, John and I, there was really no book in sports psychology. You know, like I said, it's a new field. You know, when you're teaching a class, you know, what text am I going to use? There was almost nothing. There was one thing that I just remember, it was a red book by Craig Fisher of not Oneonta, it was Ithaca. He was at Ithaca. And it was edited, but there was really nothing good. And so John and I got together and said, well, we need to do something for the field. So we got these 32 people and put that together. Again, there's no pictures, there's no graphs. There's no photos except for the photos of the people. It's all can you imagine a student today getting a book? All text.
No way.
All text. You know, our editors from Human Kinetics tell us every third page, if you don't have a picture, a figure, you know, a table, you have to put one in because they can't continue to read that much. You'll lose them. So we got to make sure we put in something. Anyway, so, okay, the book, yeah, someone, Dan. So, Rainer Martens, so that was one of the first, only books. But Rainer Martens, who I'm sure you know of anyway, was Dan's mentor, right? And at the time, Rainer became, he just started Human Kinetics, okay? Human Kinetics. So he started in his basement, you know, his major company now in his basement, typical thing. Anyway, the company had just started, and he went to Dan. He said, we need a sports psychology text. Would you write one? He goes, that's too much work. You know, the sports. Well, what if I got your co-author? Who would you want? So Dan mentions me. On the other side, myself and John Silva and Ryan Martins are negotiating, you know, to do this second edition of the book. But as you may or may not know, you don't want to have John Silva and Rainer Martens in the same room, because all your good china will be on the floor. Two bulls in the classical china shop. So they couldn't get along. They couldn't get along. And I stepped in, I called Rainer and I said, listen, just man to man, me and you, Rainer, you know, I try to soft things over. And he said, okay, I'll do it, but I'm not talking to John. Everything's going to you, so on and so forth. Then Dan asks me about, you know, you want to come do this textbook with me? Okay, so here it is, this, the gray book, you know, wanting to get it second edition, this new thing with Dan and Rainer. So all of a sudden I had two options, if you will. And I went with Dan because I just felt that the vibes were not good between John and Rainer, and they just didn't like each other or couldn't get along or whatever. And so I moved over. And then that's why he, So the first year, the year we were writing our first edition, Dan had some issues, put it that way. And I wound up writing, I don't know, two thirds of the book. He wrote a third. So he said, you know, you ought to be first author. You wrote two thirds of the book. No, you ought to be author because you guys had the idea. So we flipped a coin. I won. But we had all said everything's 50-50, regardless of how it goes. So we split royalties. We split the amount of work, chapters, whatever is 50-50. So that's that story with that book.
And now it's in its seventh edition?
It's in its seventh. We're working. It'll be in its eighth edition. It was supposed to come out in the fall, which will be this fall in November. But they have problems with paper. They can't get paper. Could you believe this? With all the supply chain, you know, stuff going on. So they had to push us back. So it's supposedly coming out in March or April of 23. So one of the things I've been doing in laying around in retirement is doing the revision of the book, which people think, oh, you just got a revision, dot some I's, cross some T's. And they'll say, well, how long does it take you to write a book like this? And I said, well, you know, we don't have the luxury of just working on the book, you know, 24/7 or whatever. We were faculty members. We had to do all the other faculty stuff. So, but I said, well, I said, it takes me about 25 hours per chapter. This is not from the beginning. This is a revision. 25 hours per chapter. I do 13 chapters, do the math. It's a lot of hours. So, you know, because once our book is published, or once the edition is published, I start a new file, 26 files, for each, or 25, whatever now, for each chapter. And as I see an article, as I read something in the Sports Illustrated or whatever, I now I do it mostly electronically, but I used to just have physical copies. So I'd have a file on motivation, a file on anxiety, a file on imagery, a file on, and then after, you know, when I was ready to write, I'd pull out the file, but then I'd also try to, you know, look at the internet and some other things. I had some colleagues I'd contact to try to, because you know how big our field is now. I mean, there are like 7 different journals, 8 different journals, just sports psych. So much stuff comes out, and you got to decide what to put in. You know, you get a lot of stuff, but you're going, does the undergraduate really need to know this? So, you got to start with that. And then you look at the chapter, what it said, you read over the chapter, then you start reading, you know, say, well, okay, here, is this article, does it need to go anywhere? Is it a good place for it? Yes, no. Sometimes, probably 2/3 of the articles we wind up discarding. It's just not relevant enough. Oh, it's in. Sometimes it's just a reference to the article. Sometimes it's a whole, what we call standalone box. You know, a whole paragraph, sometimes a couple of sentences. And we got to go through and do that. And while we do that, then we got to put in all the new references, which is a pain. And so we have to, you know, do all those kinds of things, you know, put in the new references and then take out. So you can't just put in, although they're always on our case for the, you know, book's growing, it's growing. So it's hard, but we try to take out. So we put in stuff, we take out stuff, we put in stuff, we take, and then we see, does this make sense now? We put some stuff in, we took all this out. Does this make sense? So 25 hours, 13 chapters, a lot of hours. Plus, that did not include, I'm in charge of all the test bank questions, which are about 800. So I got to go through each chapter and all the questions and see, okay, which ones are not relevant now because we took out this material, and which ones are new that we need to ask questions on. Dan has to do the same thing with PowerPoints. We have 1,000 PowerPoints. Which ones come out? Which ones come in? Again, so, and that's ancillary stuff. So then we have, I think, you know, about 80 exercises that you can use in class, out of class. We update that, so on and so forth. So anyway, big job.
Are you okay if we get questions from our students about some of our tests that we send them to you if they have concerns?
No, please send them to me. I will say every year, every time book comes out, I get a couple of emails. So this one guy goes, somehow I mentioned that Hank Aaron was the all-time home run hitter at 755 homers. He writes me an email. You made a mistake. I said, well, he goes, Hank Aaron is not the all-time home run leader. It's Barry Bonds at 762. So I wrote to him, I said, well, you might think Barry Bonds is the all-time home leader at 762, but he did it on drugs. And the real home run hitter is Hank Aaron, and that's staying in at 755.
You write the book, you can put whatever you want.
And then I'll get someone, you know, someone like, say, from Greece, you know, their last names are like 15, you know, letters. And I'll get a call. I just need to let you know that it's A-E, not E-A. You transpose these letters. And so we get stuff. Is that in jest, or is there any real thing behind that?
No, we would never do that. And it's probably more a product of our teaching than it would be the test question.
Well, I mean, sometimes I could miss something and for example, forget to take out something or take out something that I shouldn't have. And all of a sudden it's not in the book. It's not in the chapter. It's just, there's nothing on this. We can make mistakes. So just blame it on us.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, say Weinberg and Gould, I don't know what they're doing. I don't know why.
So I guess, you know, we have the fortunate privilege, like right now with you, to get a sense of in many ways, like how things started within the field and then obviously with ASP. As you reflect on your experience and kind of where things were and then how ASP has evolved over the years, what are your thoughts about the direction in terms of where ASP is going, good or bad or neutral?
It's a big question.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys even remember, but ASP started with three areas. Do you know that?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to tell you. So what are the three areas, Megan?
Oh, my gosh. Like teaching, research, consulting, three areas?
No. There were three different sections of ASP, if you will.
Of ASP.
Social psych was one.
Exercise psych?
I thought exercise was in there. And then it wasn't – I'm trying to remember the exact, like, words that were used because we talked about them as – in some business meetings as, like, silos. I remember at different points.
Well, the other one is one –
Performance enhancement?
Yeah, performance enhancement.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are the more the applied folks. And then there's social psych, exercise psych. And ASP was started – on the basic notion of the research to practice orientation, the scientist practitioner model, because people will say, "Oh, I just want to do applied stuff." I said, "Well, how can you do applied stuff if you don't know what works and what doesn't work? Is internal imagery better than external imagery? Is arousal good? Is it bad? So on and so forth." So I always look like you can't do applied sports, just do applied sports psych, because you have to know the research and what the research tells you informs you about the kind of things that are true or not true, so on and so forth. Okay, so we started out with those three, and I think we've lost that. I think we have become a society of performance enhancement, mostly. In the original beginnings, we used to have four keynotes. We had the Coleman Griffith, right? And we had one in each of those three areas, which we just mentioned. And these many times they were people from outside the field, who would come up and maybe was doing something similar, on social psych, they're doing something on perfectionism or something that related to sport. And that was it. And recently, even my students of recent years, younger than you, Megan, but people go to the conference, and now you see a bunch of coaches and athletes talking. Nothing wrong with that, but that's sort of all you see. You don't see any kind of research to practice, and you don't see any of the three areas. I think ASP has done some great things. Jack Watson in particular, I'm going to cite, in helping us get through and move us towards certification and the change in certification and focus, on the amount of hours that you have and the focus on ethics, and then the development of the test, so on and so forth. So I think ASP has made some really, important strides that way. But I think it's losing a lot of, maybe older members because, even my students would come back. I forget who did this. This was a guy, I can't remember his name. He was supposedly a big hotsy-tot person. Maybe my students, we want to go hear him speak. He's a terrible speaker. And then he didn't know the difference. He had some graph on there with task and ego orientation. And he didn't know the difference between them. And it's like, really, this is a guy who has spent a bunch of money on and so on and so forth. So anyway, I think that's, been a really good thing for ASP in terms of the focus, though, on because I said certification was the initial focus of ASP. That's why it was started. And, with all the changes and all the it's a slow process. So I think they made great changes there, but I think they have lost the science. I've seen the science have sort of gone out, and it's cool to do performance enhancements with athletes and stuff like that. And so that's my short, my long and short of some of the differences there.
What advice do you have for students and new professionals entering the field?
In terms of?
In terms of whatever you want.
In terms of whatever I want. all right. So one of the things that's still is always a question, you know, is what kind of degree should I have? Should I go to psych? Should I go to sports science? You know, so one of the things I always tell my students, particularly if they're going to be a applied sports psychology individual, is you need to have business classes, marketing, management, et cetera. I said, because you are a business. You might be an N of one business, or you might have some other people, but you're a business. And you might be the smartest, best sports psychologist in the world, but if people don't know about you, you don't have business. You have to be, and now, of course, with the internet, you know, a lot of people, you know, do advertising through that and all the different things that I can do through that. So that's one of the things. And now, you know, with the interest in mental health, of course, you know, the Simone Biles and Michael Phelps and Naomi Osaka, some of the big name people, a lot of the jobs now want some kind of counseling, clinical, mental health experience. And so the people who are trained in the classic, traditional, I'm going to kinesiology or sports science, going to focus on sports psychology, going to go out there, I'm going to do performance enhancement. Great. Except a lot of universities want someone to deal with mental health now. And if they can get two for one, so I know some of my recent students are getting master's or second master's in counseling, for example, so they can be competitive for that. Those kind of positions. I also highlight the, I don't know if you know this, Mime, that I think the biggest hire of sports science, sports psychologists are, do you know who's the biggest, does the most hiring of sports psychologists?
The military. The military. I read it in your book.
Yeah, the military, you know, and a lot of our students are in, not in the, you know, it's, they're not in the military, but they, you know, focus on that. So a lot of our students are, you know, and they get good salaries and they get good experience and stuff. And I think that's also an avenue not to force on anyone, but let them know that that's a possibility. And I think any, at Miami of Ohio anyway, any student who wanted to go into the military was accepted. They really liked our program. They liked our students. As one of the officers said, I remember talking to him, he says, I said, why do you like our students so much? He said, well, we'll ask them a question. Give me a, how would you implement an imagery training program? And they do a great job. And they said, well, tell me the science behind imagery. Tell me the theories behind imagery. He said, the Miami students, they always knew it. The other students, they just knew how to do it. They didn't know the whys and wherefores. So. So anyway,
because we had
those were a couple of things, you know, of course, you know, now you have so many more opportunities. Again, when I came out, I said there virtually was no field. There was virtually no positions. There was a position here and a position there, you know, in sports psych. But now you have, you know, I look at the AFS website or, you know, they have 12, 13, 15 jobs every time I seem to look, you know, from, you know, academic jobs, applied jobs, working with industry, so on and so forth. So there's a lot there, a lot of options, I think, in more performance, you know, kind of psychology.
So this next question, I think there's probably a couple of different ways to ask it. The question itself reads, what do you hope will be your impact on the field? And I think that that's really, really important to ask, because as we get the privilege to talk to, you know, past presidents at different points in their careers right now, you know, some that are kind of just starting out in some ways, you know, may have this vision for what they want to see happen. And their impact down the road. I would say the same for you too, as you're editing, you know, this book that has given so much to, you know, training programs in the field. So I guess I would ask the question both ways in terms of, you know, what do you think your impact has been? And then also, you know, what do you think it what do you hope it will continue to be?
Well, this may sound like a strange answer, but I've talked to Dan Gould, about this, and we both agree. Very easy. It's our textbook. Most people who go into the field of sports psychology have read our textbook. Mm-hmm. We go to Europe, and I remember I was going there, and we're treated like rock stars because of our book. I mean, people come running up to us for our autographs, you know, and a book, you know, and so on. So it may seem, you know, you might be thinking, you know, some of the research we've done or some of the, you know, some of the things we've done. But we both say our book will have the most impact because almost everyone has read part of it. Maybe the book was an impetus to really get into sports psychology. Maybe it was just something with part of their courses. But, you know, think about, because I know that in terms of new books, we have sold at over 250,000 new books.
Wow.
And we don't know, we can't track used books. So, you know, who knows how many of those. So another, I don't know, a couple 100,000, I don't have any idea. So think about all the people who've read those books that, you know, and so I think really the easy question is, although you might want to, you know, a more thoughtful question about, you know, some of the things we did, some of the research we've done, so on, but the real answer is the book.
I think it's a very appropriate answer because there's not a lot of folks out there that, besides Dan, I realize, that could say, you know, the same thing.
You know,
so it is very unique.
We certainly get, you know, people talking about our research and, you know, in our service to the field and our mentoring of students and stuff like that. But we can't get at 250,000, you know. I don't have 250,000 Megans, you know.
Lucky for you.
we got a handful, you know. We enter and they become a professor, or they do applied work, or they go into the military or whatever. But in terms of numbers, it is relatively small. It may have been a big impact on some individuals, for sure, no doubt. But if you're talking about the field in general, in large scope, 250,000.
Yeah, well, it's quite a bit.
Incredible. On the first day of class, I always tell the students that I was taught by the person who wrote their textbook, and it's always like an amazement when I tell them that. So I feel fortunate because I got to learn from you, and it's opened so many doors for me, but also I get to be cool in front of my students for 5 minutes on the first day of class, so... Great.
And thank you, by the way, because of COVID, I never had a retirement party because I retired when COVID started. But a couple of my colleagues, Dr. Chase in particular, put together a video and of colleagues and former students, Megan being one of them, who got on for 1, 2, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, maybe, you know, said what, you know, our relationship was and how much I might have meant to them and so on and so forth. And those are very, very poignant. And what's really cool about it is I can click a button and look at all 35 of them. And you know, as opposed to you did something, you had a retirement party and it's done. This is always on my desktop. You know, if I ever feel like, you know, I think I'll listen to a couple of those. You know, it's always nice to have. So it's definitely great impacts on individuals, but, you know, when you look at the field, you know, we look at the field by our impact on the book.
I will say one thing that I did not carry over from your class was the 8 a.m. 10-page essay exams, because I think I still have flashbacks to those.
I have heard similar stories. In fact, one of the students who wrote in that video said, after we took your test, we would go and celebrate. We didn't know how we did, but just because we finished your test, we would go out and have a beer or something.
Yeah, at 10 a.m. on a Friday.
And I don't know, were we using computers? Or were you writing?
No, 10 handwritten pages.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we went to computers after that because I caught, you know, after a while, I said, my wrist is hurting me, you know, I can't. But I always second guess, like, why am I giving, I have to now read all these essays? why am I doing this? Multiple choice, you know, and stuff. But I always felt, and I think I did for you and for most students, you were allowed a card that you can write on, like a 4x6 card. So I always had students write, you know, whatever they can put on, and the students were doing like 0.2 font. You know, you need a magnifying glass to, you know, see what they wrote. But they mostly would say, and they can write anything they want on it, then most of them would say, I hardly ever even looked at that during the test, because you know what? When they wrote it on the card, they remembered it. They hardly ever had to go to the card. And I always felt that, you know, you know, multiple choice, you might get lucky, you might get unlucky and stuff, but if you really want to show me if you know your stuff, it's write the essay. You know, so like, you just don't give me the answers. Like, okay, so why did you do this? What's the theory behind that? How would you apply this? And so that was not easy, but, you know, and it was long, and I had to read them and they had to write them. But I always thought that that was the best way to assess their knowledge.
Pretty sure I got a B in your class, but that's neither here nor there. As we wrap up, this has been so incredible. So again, we just both really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us. Is there anything that you think would be important to share or that we haven't asked about, either about the field or ASP?
I don't think you've really talked about the future of the field. And you expect me to say something about that? Yeah, it's interesting, you know, how the, I don't know, you know, how the future will be. It, you know, certainly, as I sort of alluded to, you know, the whole mental health issue has become a big deal with the field. It seems to be growing. But I also, you know, I remember one of my good friends and colleagues, Dan Kirschenbaum, who was the chair, oh, that's another thing that you should know, of the certification committee. He didn't ask that question. Of the there was a certification committee as we were trying to get certification, and there were a lot of big names on it, both psych and sport. Shane Murphy, Bob Neidefer, John Silver, Dan Kirschenbaum, Ron Smith, myself. I think there might have been another. That was the hardest committee I was ever on, because we never could agree. Some people say, you know, of the name. Some say, I'm a sports psychologist and I'm going to call myself a sports psychologist. No, you cannot call yourself a sports psychologist. Psychology is a protected term. You cannot use that. And we almost had someone, you know, take their ball and go home. These are all very prestigious people in the field. And Dan Kirschenbaum was the chair of that committee. And he came up with the solution. Do you know what the solution was? So half the people said we should use psychology in our title because that's what we do. Half the people said, no, you can't. It's a protected term. Unless you're a PhD, blah, blah, you can't use it. And this was, and we butt heads. And Dan Kirschenbaum came up with the solution. So do you remember what did you call yourself when you became certified?
He came up with the CCASP.
Yeah. So Megan Bird, CCASP. She's not calling herself a psychologist or a sports psychologist. She's just telling him where she got, you know, her certification. Well, if she got her certification in applied sports psychology, what the heck do you think she was doing? Wasn't doing biomechanics, wasn't doing motor learning, she was doing sports psych. I always thought that was a great compromise and a great way, you know, people forget, because that committee was, I mean, it was button heads. Psychology here, sports science here, you know, and these are very top people. And anyway, that's another little story for ASP.
That has evolved quite a bit as well.
Yeah.
I realize.
Right, yes. Quite a bit.
I think we got through, unless there's anything else, Dr. Weinberg, that came to mind. you let us pick your brain. We really, really appreciate that.
Not much to pick at anymore, but
I'm sure you've forgotten more about sports psych than some people will ever know.
Yeah, well, and again, only doing sports psychology or in that field by happenstance. I love psych and I love sport. I was a sports person. I played a lot of sports, coached them. But again, if I didn't come across the Madison Sport by Arnold Weiser, who knows? I might have just retired from New York City after 42 years of teaching and coaching instead of faculty at two universities. So you never know. And that's, I always say, you know, you never know what one person could mean to you. And just like my faculty member in at Brooklyn College, you know, telling me or certainly encouraging me to go on and get a master's degree because I was a good student and so on. If I didn't listen to him, again, I would be back doing my teaching and coaching. So both of you, you know, make sure, you know, when you're with your students, you guys can make the difference, you know, big time for an individual and where they may be going in their life or certainly in their careers.
We appreciate that. We are going to make sure we play this recording for them at the beginning of each semester so they know that going into their 2 years with us. So, and yeah, I wish I had the same. I don't have as cool of a story as Megan does in terms of her, you know, relationship and connection to you. I think the best I have, except from maybe meeting in passing at conferences, was I got to sit across the aisle from you on a plane as we were flying out to one of the conferences, and I got to watch you work on the plane. And that was that's not nearly as impressive or cool to share with our students, but that's what I have except for today now. So
wait, did you say anything?
No.
Oh, so you just like watched
I
him.
Just watched you work.
I usually don't work on planes, but maybe.
Well, it must have been another
puzzle or something.
you were probably covering it. So I guess I couldn't, it looked like it was pretty demanding, though. I mean, you seemed like you were very, in your zone in that moment. So, no, I didn't say anything. I don't know what I was going to say. So, but that's now been changed. So, because of today and your graciousness in spending your afternoon with us. So, thank you again so much, as Megan said.
The field would not be where it is without contributions such as yourself. So thank you so much. Yeah,
well, it's a pleasure. I always tell people, you know, throughout my 42-year career, I never really cared that it was Sunday night and that Monday started a work week. Or I never cared that it was Friday night and that I had a weekend, you know, to come because I enjoyed my job. And I always also said, you know, if I was offered, you know, double my salary or whatever, but you'd have to, you know, put a tie and shirt on 50 weeks a year, commute to work. I tell them they could have it. That, you know, the enjoyment and, you know, and the graduate students was, you know, one of the top things of that enjoyment, you know, to have really good graduate students over the years and to interact with them, to help them, you know, to talk with them, et cetera. You know, to go on our van rides to.
Ohio.
Yeah,
Michigan.
A lot of students remember the van rides to Midwest Conference, where the students sort of bonded, but we also sort of had a really good time, and they got to meet some people, and the students really liked it. I think we had, you know, one or two vans, you know, with students and stuff. What year were you? I don't remember your year.
I was 2009 to 2011.
So did you go on, you went on one of those or did you go on two?
We drove to Michigan State. I think, was it Michigan? Yeah, Michigan State, I think. I don't know. It's been a long time for me too. But yeah, we rode in the van and the heat wouldn't turn off.
And it was probably cold if we were going to Michigan State in February.
It was chilly, but the heat was so hot. Steve Cohen said his shoes were melting, but he's a big baby, so.
Well.
Anyway, that's a good story.
Yeah, all sorts of way people connect. Sometimes in the classroom, sometimes in the van, you know.
Sometimes in in a class. I think that is a, sometimes in a classroom, sometimes an event. And with that, we've asked, he answered. So thank you everybody for listening, and thanks Dr. Weinberg again. We really appreciate it.